365, End of North and South. Book talk begins at 10:26. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from where the Delaware River meets the Old York Road, New Hope, Pennsylvania. Episode 365, Please Ask. This episode brought to you by Survival Organs, handmade organs to throw, love, or cuddle. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. And March Hare Yarns, hand-dyed yarns just for you. You can visit the March Hare at Etsy. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. Links to all of our sponsors can be found in the show notes at craftlit.com. Remember, their support for the show is what keeps it free for you. So go have a look.
Well, hello. It is a quick episode as far as I am concerned. There's plenty of book for you to listen to, but it's a quick episode for me because I am traveling to Virginia. So when you're listening to this, I will be on the road heading down to Powhatan to go work with the kids. I am so excited. It's so much fun. These kids sent me a video and they are just adorable, wonderful children. I'm very, very happy. So that means I have to hop to it. So the first thing to share with you comes from listener Arlen, who you may recall has a fabulous Scottish accent and has read things for us on the podcast before. He read some Robert Burns and I read some voices during Dracula too, which was really lovely. But he sent me a link, and he sent it on Sunday, which is kind of interesting, because on Sunday we found out how our neighbor committed suicide. And it was extraordinary in a kind of angry, you're going to have a giant mess to clean up kind of way. And this was shocking. You don't often have this happen. And then Arlen sends me a link to the sermon that his rabbi gave on Yom Kippur, which was Saturday. Well, Friday night is when it started, but Saturday is when sermon. So the theme of the sermon is ask for help. Yes, it's a Yom Kippur sermon, which means yes, it's aimed at a room full of Jews, but I know plenty of women who are not Jewish who could benefit from reading this. People who have a hard time asking for help when it comes to themselves. Perfectly capable of asking for help for other people, but not so much when it comes to them. So the link is the first link in order of appearance on the show notes for this week. And boy, yes, please, please read it. It's lovely. And actually, you might be kind of interested too, because he writes transliterations of some Hebrew, but then he also translates it. So there may be prayers in Hebrew that you've heard just kind of because you were an adult and you hear things, and you may never have known what they mean, and now you will. And that's kind of cool too. Demystifies everything a little bit. So that very serious opening then gives way to, I forgot something last week. I forgot to put the link to the GiveWrap blog post in the show notes. So that is there now. I also have to send a big thank you to Deb, who sent me quilting needles and fabric in the mail. Tonight, I tested the quilting needle, and oh my gosh, I was so not mistaken. I really seriously had the wrong needles. What a difference. I don't even have to use a thimble with this one. It just goes right through like butter. Thank you so much, Deb. And on that same quilty note, I have a phone call, voicemail thing, from Donna about the thread that I have in my grandmother's case. I think this might be important information to disseminate. So here is Donna.
Hi, Heather. This is Donna, also known as Matka Z on Ravelry. During your podcast this week, you talked about the fact that your grandmother, you have some sewing supplies, including thread, that your grandmother gave you, that you inherited from her. And you were talking about using that thread to repair your quilt. I just wanted to let you know that you really want to think about that thread. Old thread does age, and exposure to light and time does weaken it and can actually cause it to rot. Particularly if the thread is on wooden spools, you should not use it. Particularly for something as important as this quilt that you're repairing, you really want to go out and buy some good quality new cotton thread and use that. And if this is the older thread, you might want to keep it as a keepsake, but you really shouldn't use it to repair your quilt or really any other kind of sewing.
So, I think I'm going to be throwing out a lot of that thread, actually. Lots on wooden spindles. But I'm going to keep the wooden spindles. I'll just not use the thread so much. We have another call from another listener. This is from Laura, and she has something to share with you. If you are going to Rhinebeck, which I am not this year, but if you are, have a listen.
Hi, Heather. This is Lisa Barnes calling from LMB Designs. I want to invite your listeners to join me on an exclusive tour of the New York Sheep and Wool Festival in Rhinebeck, New York, on Sunday, October 19th. As you may know, this is the premier yarn festival in the Northeast, one that knitters, crocheters, spinners, and fiber enthusiasts flock to. As a knitting designer and teacher, I have the inside scoop on how to navigate the festival and will be leading my students and fellow knitters on this adventure. The tour will include charter bus travel from the New York City, Northern New Jersey area, admission into the festival, my insider tips and tricks to help you enjoy the festival without feeling overwhelmed, private informative sessions with vendors, and special discount offers just for us, festival activities including sheep herding demonstrations, the fleece-to-shawl competition, nose-to-nose greetings with alpaca, and wine tasting of local wineries. And throughout the day, you will receive personalized knitting help and fiber advice from me. The cost is $97 with transportation, or you can meet us at the fairgrounds for only $55. If you're interested in joining us, please email me at lisa@lmbdesigns.com no later than this Monday, October 13th. Don't miss out on this exclusive tour of Rhinebeck Festival on October 19th. I hope you can join us.
So yes, I wish I were going to Rhinebeck. It sounds great, though. It sounds like a really great deal. And especially like the wine tasting part of it. I think that would be marvelous. So I hope some of you can go. It would be lovely. Make sure she knows that you are Craftlit people when you meet up, so she knows. I also have the raffle winner, finally. If I didn't do it today, it was not going to get done. Alessandra, you are the winner of that fantastic embroidery book. You should have gotten an email by now. If you haven't, please contact me at heather@craftlit.com. There will be a new raffle giveaway thing for a book in November when the show comes back from hiatus. But until then, no raffles. Unless we might do something like we did at the beginning of North and South, where there's all a kind of a frenzied giveaway kind of thing the week leading up to the start of our next book, Herland. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull that off again. If you have any ideas or anything that you think would be a good fit for that kind of extravaganza, heather@craftlit.com or 206-350-1642. Also, to remind you, Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, for whom I narrate from time to time, are doing their big Halloween October extravaganza thing. So if you like scary stories, go to the link on my show notes for 365 and go over there, because they're doing a different scary story a day for the entire month of October, which is no small feat. They are incredible over there. One of the stories that will pop up over there, but it will also pop up somewhere else, and I'll let you know, is The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Now, when we did it originally in episodes 26, 27, and 28, we had Chip reading. But since equipment has gotten better, when I went back in to listen to those podcasts, I was shocked, horrified, freaked out. I couldn't fix it. I had to re-record chunks. There were some chunks that were salvageable. So Sleepy Hollow will be coming back out, but I will be the narrator now, which is fine. I don't mind. It was a lot of fun to read. But yeah, I had to do some work on that. So Sleepy Hollow, something to watch for on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights website. And that, I think, sums it up and leaves us with North and South. So here we are. Here we are at our last three chapters. I know. How does the time fly so fast? I have no idea. But here we are, nonetheless. And they're going to go kind of quick, I have to admit. I don't know how I feel about that. Nor will you, I think. I cannot say too much about the chapters today, or I will spoil everything. But you will hear a reference to people making a bad end in America. This is not what it sounds like. This is actually a speculative investment loan-making thing that happened. In 1840, there was a problem. I think there were 9 states that were defaulting on loans that had been floated to them by banks in London. It was embarrassing. It was also a problem because it means if you were a manufacturer and you were having any kind of commerce with the United States at that time, you were going to be up a deep yogurt creek without a paddle. That's the reference. And the beginning of the first chapter, the beginning of chapter 50 that we listen to, is a kind of a third person broad summation of a place and a time. It's really lovely writing too, but that's where that particular piece of information is going to kick in. You will also hear 2 references that I think are just really cool. And especially if you are listening to Sherlock Holmes over on the premium audio feed, one of these is going to make you smile. The first is the phrase cash nexus. Now, some people have said that that came from Karl Marx. It didn't. It came from, and this is what the Sherlock people are going to smile at, Thomas Carlyle. Carlyle's quote is, eventually in the future, we will arrive at a place when cash payment has become the sole nexus of man to man. Meaning we won't have any other kind of commerce. We won't have sitting down at a table and having coffee with each other commerce. We won't have face-to-face commerce. We won't have these moments of exchange unless they have to do with money. And so that was a Carlyle prediction, and that's the phrase cash nexus. And the other really cool one, I love this one. You're going to hear this phrase, but it might be the point Archimedes sought from which to move the earth. I'm going to say it again, but better. It might be the point Archimedes sought from which to move the earth. Now, this is referring to something that Archimedes, evidently back in ancient Greece, one of the things he thought about when he was thinking was, wow, wouldn't it be interesting if we could find some place outside of the earth, outside of our little blue marble in space, and if you could go there and you could stand there, I bet you could actually move the earth. He was thinking about leverage. And, you know, if you have a pry bar big enough, you could just stick it under the earth and have the thing roll away. Well, what this came to mean in conversation was something that's possible in theory, but impossible in reality. Like, yeah, wouldn't that be great to go stand somewhere and move the earth with a rod? Way to go. Not going to happen, but really cool idea. Oh my gosh, I feel like every conversation I have with my 14-year-old is like that. In theory, that's a great idea, but really, no, not so much. And those really are the only things that I need to give you a heads up on, because again, once you get towards the end of the book, everything goes as it goes, really. So here we go, listening to chapters 50, 51, and 52 of North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell.
Chapter 50. Changes at Milton. Here we go up, 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 and here we go down, down, downy. Nursery song. Meanwhile, at Milton, the chimney smoked, the ceaseless roar and mighty beat and dizzying whirl of machinery struggled and strove perpetually. Senseless and purposeless were wood and iron and steam in their endless labors, but the persistence of their monotonous work was rivaled in tireless endurance by the strong crowds who, with sense and with purpose, were busy and restless in seeking after what? In the streets there were few loiterers, none walking for mere pleasure. Every man's face was set in lines of eagerness or anxiety. News was sought for with fierce avidity, and men jostled each other aside in the mart and in the exchange, as they did in life, in the deep selfishness of competition. There was gloom over the town. Few came to buy, and those who did were looked at suspiciously by the sellers, for credit was insecure, and the most stable might have their fortunes affected by the sweep in the great neighboring port among the shipping houses. Hitherto, there had been no failures in Milton, but from the immense speculations that had come to light in making a bad end in America, and yet nearer home, it was known that some Milton houses of business must suffer so severely that every day men's faces asked, if their tongues did not, "What news? Who is gone? How will it affect me?" And if two or three spoke together, they dwelt rather on the names of those who were safe than dared to hint at those likely, in their opinion, to go. For idle breath may, at such times, cause the downfall of some who might otherwise weather the storm, and one going down drags many after. "Thornton is safe," say they. "His business is large, extending every year, but such a head as he has, and so prudent with all his daring." Then one man draws another aside and walks a little apart, and, with head inclined into his neighbor's ear, he says, "Thornton's business is large, but he has spent his profits in extending it. He has no capital laid by. His machinery is new within these 2 years and has cost him. We won't say what. A word to the wise." But that Mr. Harrison was a croaker. A man who had succeeded to his father's trade-made fortune, which he had feared to lose by altering his mode of business to any having a larger scope. Yet he grudged every penny made by others more daring and far-sighted. But the truth was, Mr. Thornton was hard-pressed. He felt it acutely in his vulnerable point, his pride in the commercial character which he had established for himself. Architect of his own fortunes, he attributed this to no special merit or qualities of his own, but to the power which he believed that commerce gave to every brave, honest, and persevering man to raise himself to a level from which he might see and read the great game of worldly success, and honestly, by such far-sightedness, command more power and influence than in any other mode of life. Far away, in the East and in the West, where his person would never be known, his name was to be regarded, and his wishes to be fulfilled, and his word pass like gold. That was the idea of merchant life with which Mr. Thornton had started. "Her merchants be like princes," said his mother, reading the text aloud as if it were a trumpet call to invite her boy to the struggle. He was but like many others, men, women, and children, alive to distant and dead to near things. He sought to possess the influence of a name in foreign countries and faraway seas, to become the head of a firm that should be known for generations, and it had taken him long silent years to come even to a glimmering of what he might be now, today, here in his own town, his own factory, among his own people. He and they had led parallel lives, very close but never touching, till the accident, or so it seemed, of his acquaintance with Higgins. Once brought face to face, man to man, with an individual of the masses around him, and, take notice, out of the character of master and workman in the first instance, they had each begun to recognize that we have all of us one human heart. It was the fine point of the wedge, and until now when the apprehension of losing his connection with two or three of the workmen whom he had so lately begun to know as men, of having a plan or two, which were experiments lying very close to his heart, roughly nipped off without trial, gave a new poignancy to the subtle fear that came over him from time to time. Until now, he had never recognized how much and how deep was the interest he had grown of late to feel in his position as manufacturer, simply because it led him into such close contact and gave him the opportunity of so much power among a race of people strange, shrewd, ignorant, but above all, full of character and strong human feeling. He reviewed his position as a Milton manufacturer. The strike a year and a half ago, or more, for it was now untimely wintry weather in a late spring. That strike, when he was young, and he now was old, had prevented his completing some of the large orders he had then on hand. He had locked up a good deal of his capital in new and expensive machinery, and he had also bought cotton largely for the fulfillment of these orders taken under contract. That he had not been able to complete them was owing in some degree to the utter want of skill on the part of the Irish hands whom he had imported. Much of their work was damaged and unfit to be sent forth by a house which prided itself on turning out nothing but first-rate articles. For many months, the embarrassment caused by the strike had been an obstacle in Mr. Thornton's way, and often, when his eye fell on Higgins, he could have spoken angrily to him without any present cause, just from feeling how serious was the injury that had arisen from this affair in which he was implicated. But when he became conscious of this sudden, quick resentment, he resolved to curb it. It would not satisfy him to avoid Higgins. He must convince himself that he was master over his own anger by being particularly careful to allow Higgins access to him whenever the strict rules of business or Mr. Thornton's leisure permitted. And by, he lost all sense of resentment in wonder how it was, or could be, that two men like himself and Higgins, living by the same trade, working in their different ways at the same object, could look upon each other's position and duties in so strangely different a way. And thence arose that intercourse, which, though it might not have the effect of preventing all future clash of opinion and action, when the occasion arose, would, at any rate, enable both master and man to look upon each other with far more charity and sympathy, and bear with each other more patiently and kindly. Besides this improvement of feeling, both Mr. Thornton and his workmen found out their ignorance as to positive matters of fact, known heretofore to one side, but not to the other. But now had come one of those periods of bad trade when the market falling brought down the value of all large stocks. Mr. Thornton's fell to nearly half. No orders were coming in, so he lost the interest of the capital he had locked up in machinery. Indeed, it was difficult to get payment for the orders completed, yet there was the constant drain of expenses for working the business. Then the bills became due for the cotton he had purchased, and money being scarce, he could only borrow at exorbitant interest, and yet he could not realize any of his property. But he did not despair. He exerted himself day and night to foresee and to provide for all emergencies. He was as calm and gentle to the women in his home as ever. To the workmen in his mill he spoke not many words, but they knew him by this time, and many a curt, decided answer was received by them rather with sympathy for the care they saw pressing upon him than with the suppressed antagonism which had formerly been smoldering and ready for hard words and hard judgments on all occasions. "The master's a deal to potter him," said Higgins one day, as he heard Mr. Thornton's short, sharp inquiry why such a command had not been obeyed, and caught the sound of the suppressed sigh which he heaved in going past the room where some of the men were working. Higgins and another man stopped over hours that night, unknown to anyone, to get the neglected piece of work done. And Mr. Thornton never knew but that the overlooker, to whom he had given the command in the first instance, had done it himself. "Eh, I reckon I know who'd have been sorry for to see our master sitting so like a piece of grey calico.
The old parson would have fretted his woman's heart out if he'd seen the woeful looks I have seen on a master's face, thought Higgins one day, as he was approaching Mr. Thornton in Marlborough Street. Master, said he, stopping his employer in his quick, resolved walk, and causing that gentleman to look up with a sudden annoyed start, as if his thoughts had been far away. Have ye heard aught of Miss Margaret lately?
Miss who? Replied Mr. Thornton.
Miss Margaret, Miss Ale, the old parson's daughter. You know who I mean well enough if you'll only think a bit.
There was nothing disrespectful in the tone in which this was said. Oh, yes. And suddenly the wintry, frost-bound look of care had left Mr. Thornton's face, as if some soft summer gale had blown all anxiety away from his mind. And though his mouth was as much compressed as before, his eyes smiled out benignly on his questioner.
She's my landlord now, you know, Higgins. I hear of her through her agent here every now and then. She's well and among friends. Thank you, Higgins.
That thank you that lingered after the other words, and yet came with so much warmth of feeling, let in a new light to the acute Higgins. It might be but a will-o'-the-wisp, but he thought he would follow it and ascertain whither it would lead him.
And she's not getting married, master?
Not yet. The face was cloudy once more. There is some talk of it, as I understand, with a connection of the family.
Then she'll not be coming for Milton again, I reckon.
No.
Stop a minute, master.
Then, going up confidentially close, he said,
Is the young gentleman cleared?
He enforced the depth of his intelligence by a wink of the eye, which only made things more mysterious to Mr. Thornton.
The young gentleman, I mean. Master Frederick, they called him. Her brother as was over here, you know.
Over here?
Aye, to be sure, at the missus' death. You need not be afeard of my telling, for Mary and me, we knowed it all along, only we held our peace, for we got it through Mary working in the house.
And he was over? It was her brother.
Sure enough, and I reckon you knowed it, or I'd never a let on. You knowed she had a brother.
Yes, I know all about him, and he was over at Mrs. Hale's death.
Nay, I'm not going for to tell more. I may be getting them into mischief already, for they kept it very close. I no but wanted to know if they'd getten him cleared.
Not that I know of. I know nothing. I only hear of Miss Hale now as my landlord through her lawyer. He broke off from Higgins to follow the business on which he had been bent when the latter first accosted him, leaving Higgins baffled in his endeavour.
It was her brother, said Mr. Thornton to himself. I'm glad. I may never see her again, but it is a comfort, a relief, to know that much. I knew she could not be unmaidenly, and yet I yearned for conviction. Now I am glad.
It was a little golden thread running through the dark web of his present fortunes, which were growing ever gloomier and more gloomy. His agent had largely trusted a house in the American trade, which went down, along with several others, just at this time, like a pack of cards, the fall of one compelling other failures. What were Mr. Thornton's engagements? Could he stand? Night after night he took books and papers into his own private room and sat up there long after the family were gone to bed. He thought that no one knew of this occupation of the hours he should have spent in sleep. One morning, when daylight was stealing in through the crevices of his shutters, and he had never been in bed, and, in hopeless indifference of mind, was thinking that he could do without the hour or two of rest, which was all that he should be able to take before the stir of daily labor began again, the door of his room opened, and his mother stood there, dressed as she had been the day before. She had never laid herself down to slumber any more than he. Their eyes met. Their faces were cold and rigid and wan from long watching.
Mother, why are you not in bed?
Son John, said she,
Do you think I can sleep with an easy mind while you keep awake full of care? You have not told me what your trouble is, but sore trouble you have had these many days past. Trade is bad. And you dread? I dread nothing, replied he, drawing up his head and holding it erect. I know now that no man will suffer by me. That was my anxiety. But how do you stand? Shall you? Will it be a failure? Her steady voice trembling in an unwanted manner. Not a failure. I must give up business, but I pay all men. I might redeem myself. I am sorely tempted.
How? Oh, John, keep up your name. Try all risks for that. How redeem it?
By speculation offered to me full of risk, but if successful, placing me high above watermark, so that no one need ever know the strait I am in. Still, if it fails.
And if it fails, said she, advancing and laying her hand on his arm, her eyes full of eager light. She held her breath to hear the end of his speech.
Honest men are ruined by a rogue, said he gloomily. As I stand now, my creditors, money is safe, every farthing of it, but I don't know where to find my own. It may be all gone and I penniless at this moment. Therefore, it is my creditors' money that I should risk.
But if it succeeded, they need never know. Is it so desperate a speculation? I'm sure it is not, or you would never have thought of it. If it succeeded,
I should be a rich man and my peace of conscience would be gone.
Why, you would have injured no one?
No, but I should have run the risk of ruining many for my own paltry aggrandizement. Mother, I have decided. You won't much grieve over our leaving this house, shall you, dear mother?
No, but to have you other than what you are will break my heart. What can you do?
Be always the same John Thornton in whatever circumstances, endeavouring to do right and making great blunders, and then trying to be brave and setting to afresh. But it is hard, Mother. I have so worked and planned. I have discovered new powers in my situation too late, and now all is over. I am too old to begin again with the same heart. It is hard, Mother.
He turned away from her and covered his face with his hands.
I can't think, said she with gloomy defiance in her tone, how it comes about. Here is my boy, good son, just man, tender heart, and he fails in all he sets his mind upon. He finds a woman to love, and she cares no more for his affection than if he had been any common man. He labours, and his labour comes to naught. Other people prosper and grow rich, and hold their paltry names high and dry above shame.
Shame never touched me,
said he in a low tone, but she went on.
I sometimes have wondered where justice was gone to. And now I don't believe there is such a thing in the world. Now you are come to this. You, my own John Thornton, though you and I may be beggars together, my own dear son.
She fell upon his neck and kissed him through her tears.
Mother, said he, holding her gently in his arms, who has sent me my lot in life, both of good and of evil?
She shook her head. She would have nothing to do with religion just then.
Mother, he went on, seeing that she would not speak, I too have been rebellious, but I am striving to be so no longer. Help me as you helped me when I was a child. Then you said many good words when my father died, and we were sometimes sorely short of comfort, which we shall never be now. You said brave, noble, trustful words then, Mother, which I have never forgotten, though they may have lain dormant. Speak to me again in the old way, Mother. Do not let us have to think that the world has too much hardened our hearts. If you would say the old good words, it would make me feel something of the pious simplicity of my childhood. I say them to myself, but they would come differently from you, remembering all the cares and trials you have had to bear.
I have had many, said she, sobbing, but none so sore as this. To see you cast down from your rightful place. I could say it for myself, John, but not for you. God has seemed to be very hard on you, very.
She shook with the sobs that come so convulsively when an old person weeps. The silence around her struck her at last, and she quieted herself to listen. No sound. She looked. Her son sat by the table, his arms thrown half across it, his head bent face downwards.
Oh, John, she said,
and she lifted his face up. Such a strange, pallid look of gloom was on it that for a moment it struck her that this look was the forerunner of death. But as the rigidity melted out of the countenance and the natural color returned, and she saw that he was himself once again, all worldly mortification sank to nothing before the consciousness of the great blessing that he himself, by his simple existence, was to her. She thanked God for this, and this alone, with a fervor that swept away all rebellious feelings from her mind. He did not speak readily, but he went and opened the shutters and let the ruddy light of dawn flood the room. But the wind was in the east. The weather was piercing cold, as it had been for weeks. There would be no demand for light summer goods this year. That hope for the revival of trade must utterly be given up. It was a great comfort to have had this conversation with his mother, and to feel sure that, however they might henceforward keep silence on all these anxieties, they yet understood each other's feelings and were, if not in harmony, at least not in discord with each other in their way of viewing them. Fanny's husband was vexed at Thornton's refusal to take any share in the speculation which he had offered to him, and withdrew from any possibility of being supposed able to assist him with the ready money, which indeed the speculator needed for his own venture. There was nothing for it at last but that which Mr. Thornton had dreaded for many weeks. He had to give up the business in which he had been so long engaged with so much honor and success, and look out for a subordinate situation. Marlborough Mills and the adjacent dwelling were held under a long lease. They must, if possible, be relet. There was an immediate choice of situations offered to Mr. Thornton. Mr. Hamper would have been only too glad to have secured him as a steady and experienced partner for his son, whom he was setting up with a large capital in a neighboring town. But the young man was half-educated as regarded information, and wholly uneducated as regarded any other responsibility than that of getting money, and brutalized both as to his pleasures and his pains. Mr. Thornton declined having any share in a partnership which would frustrate what few plans he had that survived the wreck of his fortunes. He would sooner consent to be only a manager, where he could have a certain degree of power beyond the mere money-getting part, than have to fall in with the tyrannical humors of a moneyed partner with whom he felt sure that he should quarrel in a few months. So he waited, and stood on one side with profound humility, as the news swept through the exchange of the enormous fortune which his brother-in-law had made by his daring speculation. It was a 9 days' wonder. Success brought with it its worldly consequence of extreme admiration. No one was considered so wise and far-seeing as Mr. Watson. Chapter 51 Meeting Again. Bear up, brave heart. We will be calm and strong. Sure, we can master eyes or cheek or tongue, nor let the smallest telltale sign appear. She ever was and is and will be dear. Rhyming play. It was a hot summer's evening. Edith came into Margaret's bedroom, the first time in her habit, the second ready dressed for dinner. No one was there at first. The next time, Edith found Dixon laying out Margaret's dress on the bed.
but no Margaret. Edith remained to fidget about.
Oh, Dixon, not those horrid blue flowers to that dead gold-colored gown. What taste! Wait a minute, and I will bring you some pomegranate blossoms.
It's not a dead gold color, Mum. It's straw color, and blue always goes with straw color.
But Edith had brought the brilliant scarlet flowers before Dixon had got half through her remonstrance.
Where is Miss Hale?
Asked Edith as soon as she had tried the effect of the garniture.
I can't think, she went on pettishly, how my aunt allowed her to get into such rambling habits in Milton. I'm sure I'm always expecting to hear of her having met with something horrible among all those wretched places she pokes herself into. I should never dare to go down some of those streets without a servant. They're not fit for ladies.
Dixon was still huffed about her despised taste, so she replied rather shortly,
It's no wonder to my mind when I hear ladies talk such a deal about being ladies, and when they're such fearful, delicate, dainty ladies, too. I say it's no wonder to me that there are no longer any saints on earth.
Oh, Margaret, here you are. I have been so wanting you. But how your cheeks are flushed with the heat, poor child. But only think what that tiresome Henry has done. Really, he exceeds brother-in-law's limits. Just when my party was made up so beautifully, fitted in so precisely for Mr. Colthurst, there Henry has to come, with an apology, it is true, and making use of your name for an excuse, and asked me if he may bring that Mr. Thornton of Milton, your tenant, you know, who is in London about some law business. It will spoil my number quite.
I don't mind dinner. I don't want any, said Margaret in a low voice.
Dixon can get me a cup of tea here, and I will be in the drawing room by the time you come up. I shall really be glad to lie down.
No, no, that will never do. You do look wretchedly white, to be sure, but that is just the heat, and we can't do without you, possibly. Those flowers a little lower, Dixon. They look glorious flames, Margaret, in your black hair. You know, we planned you to talk about Milton to Mr. Colthurst. Oh, to be sure, and this man comes from Milton. I believe it will be capital after all. Mr. Colthurst can pump him well on all the subjects in which he is interested, and it will be great fun to trace out your experiences and this Mr. Thornton's wisdom in Mr. Colthurst's next speech in the House. Really, I think it is a happy hit of Henry's. I asked him if he was a man one would be ashamed of, and he replied, Not if you've any sense in you, my little sister. So I suppose he is able to sound his H's, which is not a common Darkshire accomplishment, eh, Margaret?
Mr. Lennox did not say why Mr. Thornton was come up to town. Was it law business connected with the property? Asked Margaret in a constrained voice.
Oh, he's failed, or something of the kind. That Henry told you of the day you had such a headache. What was it? There, that's capital, Dixon. Miss Hale does us credit, does she not? I wish I was as tall as a queen and as brown as a gypsy, Margaret.
But about Mr. Thornton?
Oh, I really have such a terrible head for law business. Henry will like nothing better than to tell you all about it. I know the impression he made upon me was that Mr. Thornton is very badly off, and a very respectable man, and that I am to be very civil to him. And as I did not know how, I came to you to ask you to help me. And now come down with me and rest on the sofa for 1/4 hour.
The privileged brother-in-law came early, and Margaret, reddening as she spoke, began to ask him the questions she wanted to hear answered about Mr. Thornton.
He came up about this subletting the property, Marlborough Mills, and the house, and the premises adjoining, I mean. He is unable to keep it on, and there are deeds and leases to be looked over and agreements to be drawn up. I hope Edith will receive him properly, but she was rather put out, as I could see, by the liberty I had taken in begging for an invitation for him. But I thought you would like to have some attention shown him.
And one would be particularly scrupulous in paying every respect to a man who is going down in the world.
He had dropped his voice to speak to Margaret, by whom he was sitting. But as he ended, he sprang up and introduced Mr. Thornton, who had that moment entered, to Edith and Captain Lennox. Margaret looked with an anxious eye at Mr. Thornton while he was thus occupied. It was considerably more than a year since she had seen him, and events had occurred to change him much in that time. His fine figure yet bore him above the common height of men, and gave him a distinguished appearance from the ease of motion which arose out of it, and was natural to him. But his face looked older and careworn. Yet a noble composure sat upon it, which impressed those who had just been hearing of his changed position, with a sense of inherent dignity and manly strength. He was aware, from the first glance he had given round the room, that Margaret was there. He had seen her intent look of occupation as she listened to Mr. Henry Lennox, and he came up to her with the perfectly regulated manner of an old friend. With his first calm words, a vivid color flashed into her cheeks, which never left them again during the evening. She did not seem to have much to say to him. She disappointed him by the quiet way in which she asked what seemed to him to be the merely necessary questions respecting her old acquaintances in Milton. But others came in, more intimate in the house than he, and he fell into the background, where he and Mr. Lennox talked together from time to time.
"You think Miss Hale looking well," said Mr. Lennox, "don't you? Milton didn't agree with her, I imagine, for when she first came to London, I thought I'd never seen anyone so much changed. Tonight she is looking radiant. But she is much stronger. Last autumn she was fatigued with a walk of a couple of miles. On Friday evening we walked up to Hampstead and back. Yet on Saturday she looked as well as she does now."
"We? Who? They two alone?"
Mr. Colthurst was a very clever man and a rising member of Parliament. He had a quick eye at discerning character and was struck by a remark which Mr. Thornton made at dinner time. He inquired from Edith who that gentleman was, and rather to her surprise, she found from the tone of his "indeed" that Mr. Thornton of Milton was not such an unknown name to him as she had imagined it would be. Her dinner was going off well. Henry was in good humor and brought out his dry, caustic wit admirably. Mr. Thornton and Mr. Colthurst found one or two mutual subjects of interest which they could only touch upon then, reserving them for more private after-dinner talk. Margaret looked beautiful in the pomegranate flowers, and if she did lean back in her chair and speak but little, Edith was not annoyed, for the conversation flowed on smoothly without her. Margaret was watching Mr. Thornton's face. He never looked at her, so she might study him unobserved and note the changes which even this short time had wrought in him. Only at some unexpected mot of Mr. Lennox's, his face flashed out into the old look of intense enjoyment. The merry brightness returned to his eyes, the lips just parted to suggest the brilliant smile of former days, and for an instant his glance instinctively sought hers, as if he wanted her sympathy. But when their eyes met, his whole countenance changed. He was grave and anxious once more, and he resolutely avoided even looking near her again during dinner. There were only two ladies besides their own party, and as these were occupied in conversation by her aunt and Edith when they went up into the drawing-room, Margaret languidly employed herself about some work. Presently, the gentlemen came up, Mr. Colthurst and Mr. Thornton in close conversation. Mr. Lennox drew near to Margaret and said in a low voice, "I really think Edith owes me thanks for my contribution to her party. You've no idea what an agreeable, sensible fellow this tenant of yours is. He has been the very man to give Colthurst all the facts he wanted coaching in. I can't conceive how he contrived to mismanage his affairs."
"With his powers and opportunities, you would have succeeded," said Margaret. He did not quite relish the tone in which she spoke, although the words but expressed a thought which had passed through his own mind.
As he was silent, they caught a swell in the sound of conversation going on near the fireplace between Mr. Colthurst and Mr. Thornton.
I assure you, I heard it spoken of with great interest, curiosity as to its result, perhaps I should rather say. I heard your name frequently mentioned during my short stay in the neighborhood.
Then they lost some words, and when next they could hear Mr. Thornton was speaking.
I have not the elements for popularity. If they spoke of me in that way, they were mistaken. I fall slowly into new projects, and I find it difficult to let myself be known, even by those whom I desire to know, and with whom I would fain have no reserve. Yet, even with all these drawbacks, I felt that I was on the right path, and that, starting from a kind of friendship with one, I was becoming acquainted with many. The advantages were mutual. We were both unconsciously and consciously teaching each other.
You say were. I trust you are intending to pursue the same course.
I must stop Colthurst, said Henry Lennox hastily. And by an abrupt yet apropos question, he turned the current of the conversation so as not to give Mr. Thornton the mortification of acknowledging his want of success and consequent change of position. But as soon as the newly started subject had come to a close, Mr. Thornton resumed the conversation just where it had been interrupted and gave Mr. Colthurst the reply to his inquiry.
I have been unsuccessful in business and have had to give up my position as master. I am on the lookout for a situation in Milton where I may meet with employment under someone who will be willing to let me go along my own way in such matters as these. I can depend upon myself for having no go-ahead theories that I would rashly bring into practice. My only wish is to have the opportunity of cultivating some intercourse with the hands beyond the mere cash nexus. But it might be the point Archimedes sought from which to move the earth, to judge from the importance attached to it by some of our manufacturers who shake their heads and look grave as soon as I name the one or two experiments that I should like to try.
You call them experiments, I notice, said Mr. Colthurst with a delicate increase of respect in his manner. Because I believe them to be such. I'm not sure of the consequences that may result from them. But I am sure they ought to be tried. I have arrived at the conviction that no mere institutions, however wise and however much thought may have been required to organize and arrange them, can attach class to class as they should be attached, unless the working out of such institutions bring the individuals of the different classes into actual personal contact. Such intercourse is at the very breath of life. A working man can hardly be made to feel and know how much his employer may have labored in his study at plans for the benefit of his workpeople. A complete plan emerges like a piece of machinery, apparently fitted for every emergency. But the hands accept it as they do machinery, without understanding the intense mental labor and forethought required to bring it to such perfection. But I would take an idea, the working out of which would necessitate personal intercourse. It might not go well at first, but at every hitch, interest would be felt by an increasing number of men, and at last its success in working come to be desired by all, as all had borne a part in the formation of the plan. And even then I am sure that it would lose its vitality, cease to be living as soon as it was no longer carried on by that sort of common interest which invariably makes people find means and ways of seeing each other and becoming acquainted with each other's characters and persons and even tricks of temper and modes of speech. We should understand each other better, and I'll venture to say we should like each other more.
And you think they may prevent the recurrence of strikes?
Not at all. My utmost expectation only goes so far as this, that they may render strikes not the bitter, venomous sources of hatred they have hitherto been. A more hopeful man might imagine that a closer and more genial intercourse between classes might do away with strikes. But I am not a hopeful man.
Suddenly, as if a new idea had struck him, He crossed over to where Margaret was sitting, and began without preface, as if he knew she had been listening to all that had passed.
"Miss Ale, I had a round robin from some of my men. I suspect in Higgins' handwriting, stating their wish to work for me if ever I was in a position to employ men again on me own behalf. That was good, wasn't it?"
"Yes, just right. I am glad of it," said Margaret, looking up straight into his face with her speaking eyes, and then dropping them under his eloquent glance. He gazed back at her for a minute, as if he did not know exactly what he was about, then sighed and said,
"I knew you would like it."
He turned away and never spoke to her again until he bid her a formal good night. As Mr. Lennox took his departure, Margaret said, with a blush that she could not repress, and with some hesitation,
"Can I speak to you tomorrow? I want your help about something."
"Certainly. I will come at whatever time you name. You cannot give me a greater pleasure than by making me of any use. At 11? Very well."
His eye brightened with exultation. How she was learning to depend upon him. It seemed as if any day now might give him the certainty, without having which he had determined never to offer to her again.
Chapter 52. Pack clouds away. For joy or grief, for hope or fear, for all hereafter as for here, in peace or strife, in storm or shine. Anonymous. Edith went about on tiptoe and checked Sholto in all loud speaking that next morning, as if any sudden noise would interrupt the conference that was taking place in the drawing room. 2 o'clock came, and they still sat there with closed doors. Then there was a man's footstep running downstairs, and Edith peeped out of the drawing room.
"Well, Henry?" said she with a look of interrogation.
"Well," said he rather shortly.
"Come in to lunch?"
"No, thank you, I can't. I've lost too much time here already."
"Then it's not all settled," said Edith despondingly.
"No, not at all. It never will be settled if the it is what I conjecture you mean. That will never be, Edith, so give up thinking about it."
"But it would be so nice for us all," pleaded Edith. "I should always feel comfortable about the children if I had Margaret settled down near me. As it is, I'm always afraid of her going off to Cadiz."
"I will try, when I marry, to look out for a young lady who has a knowledge of the management of children. That is all I can do. Miss Hale would not have me, and I shall not ask her."
"Then what have you been talking about?"
"A thousand things you would not understand. Investments and leases and value of land."
"Oh, go away if that's all. You and she will be unbearably stupid if you've been talking all this time about such weary things."
"Very well. I am coming again tomorrow and bringing Mr. Thornton with me to have some more talk with Miss Hale."
"Mr. Thornton? What has he to do with it?"
"He is Miss Hale's tenant," said Mr. Lennox, turning away. "And he wishes to give up his lease."
"Oh, very well. I can't understand details, so don't give them me."
"The only detail I want you to understand is to let us have the back drawing room undisturbed, as it was today. In general, the children and servants are so in and out that I can never get any business satisfactorily explained, and the arrangements we have to make tomorrow are of importance."
No one ever knew why Mr. Lennox did not keep to his appointment on the following day. Mr. Thornton came, true to his time, and, after keeping him waiting for nearly an hour, Margaret came in looking very white and anxious. She began hurriedly,
"I am so sorry Mr. Lennox is not here. He could have done it so much better than I can. He is my adviser in this.
I'm sorry that I came if it troubles you. Shall I go to Mr. Lennox's chambers and try to find him?
No, thank you. I wanted to tell you how grieved I was to find that I am to lose you as a tenant, but Mr. Lennox says things are sure to brighten.
Mr. Lennox knows little about it, said Mr. Thornton quietly. Happy and fortunate in all a man cares for, he does not understand what it is to find oneself no longer young, yet thrown back to the starting point which requires the hopeful energy of youth. To feel one half a life gone and nothing done, nothing remaining of wasted opportunity, but the bitter recollection that it has been. Miss Ale, I would rather not hear Mr. Lennox's opinion of my affairs. Those who are happy and successful themselves are too apt to make light of the misfortunes of others.
You are unjust, said Margaret gently. Mr. Lennox has only spoken of the great probability which he believes there to be of your redeeming, your more than redeeming what you have lost. Don't speak till I have ended. Pray don't.
And collecting herself once more, she went on rapidly turning over some law papers and statements of accounts in a trembling, hurried manner.
Oh, here it is. And he drew me out a proposal. I wish he was here to explain it, showing that if you would take some money of mine, £18,057, lying just at this moment unused in the bank and bringing me in only 2.5%, you could pay me much better interest and might go on working Marlborough Mills.
Her voice had cleared itself and become more steady. Mr. Thornton did not speak, and she went on looking for some paper on which were written down the proposals for security, for she was most anxious to have it all looked upon in the light of a mere business arrangement in which the principal advantage would be on her side. While she sought for this paper, her very heart pulse was arrested by the tone in which Mr. Thornton spoke. His voice was hoarse and trembling with tender passion as he said, "Margaret." For an instant she looked up, and then sought to veil her luminous eyes by dropping her forehead on her hands. Again, stepping nearer, he besought her with another tremulous, eager call upon her name. "Margaret!" Still lower went the head, more closely hidden was the face, almost resting on the table before her. He came close to her. He knelt by her side, to bring his face to a level with her ear, and whispered, panted out the words, "Take care. If you do not speak, I shall claim you as my own in some strange, presumptuous way. Send me away at once if I must go, Margaret." At that third call, she turned her face, still covered with her small white hands, towards him, and laid it on his shoulder, hiding it even there. And it was too delicious to feel her soft cheek against his for him to wish to see either deep blushes or loving eyes. He clasped her close, but they both kept silence. At length she murmured in a broken voice,
"Oh, Mr. Thornton, I am not good enough."
"Not good enough. Don't mock my own deep feeling of unworthiness."
After a minute or two, he gently disengaged her hands from her face and laid her arms as they had once before been placed to protect him from the rioters.
"Do you remember, love," he murmured, "and how I requited you with my insolence the next day?"
"I remember how wrongly I spoke to you, that is all."
"Look here, lift up your head. I have something to show you."
She slowly faced him, glowing with beautiful shame.
"Do you know these roses?" he said, drawing out his pocketbook, in which were treasured up some dead flowers.
"No," she replied with innocent curiosity. "Did I give them to you?"
"No, vanity, you did not. You may have worn sister roses, very probably."
She looked at them, wondering for a minute. Then she smiled a little as she said,
"They're from Helston, are they not? I know the deep indentations round the leaves. Oh, have you been there? When were you there?"
"I wanted to see the place where Margaret grew to what she is, even at the worst time of all, when I had no hope of ever calling her mine. I went there on my return from Havre."
"You must give them to me," she said,
trying to take them out of his hand with gentle violence.
"Very well. Only, you must pay me for them."
"How shall I ever tell Aunt Shaw?"
she whispered after some time of delicious silence.
"Let me speak to her."
"Oh, no, I owe to her. But what will she say?"
"I can guess. Her first exclamation will be, 'That man?'"
"Hush," said Margaret, "or I shall try and show you your mother's indignant tones, as she says, 'That woman?'"
I know, right? That's it. That's all you get. Enjoy it while you can, because it goes by really fast. It is quite literally the last page of the book where Margaret puts her head on Thornton's shoulder. But I love their little statements to each other. "That man, that woman." Boom. Done. Curtain. The end. And scene. It's just, I've never read a book from this period that had the cojones to actually pull something like this off. We're supposedly reading a romance, and there has been zero gooiness. Which may be why I like the book so much, because it's not that kind of romance. It's the romance of watching Margaret figure out who she is and growing up and learning all this legal stuff from Henry Lennox. And okay, I feel real bad about Henry, right? Because he had to sit there and help her with all this legal stuff, knowing that she was in love with Thornton. Because he's not stupid or mean. Or a horrible person. And you know, if she had wound up with him, they probably would have done just fine. I did have a couple of issues with Thornton in this section. First, when he finds out that it was Frederick, he's just relieved. And it's interesting because he does criticize himself, saying, "I knew she couldn't have done that. And still I needed confirmation." And that's just kind of bleh. But he's saying that about himself. And I thought he was marvelous in the scene at the dinner party when he goes back and owns up to the fact that, no, I'm actually looking for a position because things didn't work out. And of course, he doesn't tell anyone else that things didn't work out because he wouldn't invest in this crazy radical scheme that could have lost everything and made it impossible for him to pay his workers. Instead, he just lets it be, "It didn't work. I failed." Boom. And Margaret, finding a way to not insult him and loan him the money, but in a way that would actually make her more money in the long term. So he couldn't say no, because there's no way it could be seen as taking advantage of her, and he'd get to keep Marlborough Mill. And presumably, it was her insisting, "No, it has to be a good deal for me, but it also has to be a good deal for him and keep the mill open. I can do better, but he still has to get that." And you can imagine Henry Lennox just going, there is no way to do this. This is insane. Why are we doing it this way? And then the end, that marvelous end, where he puts her arms around his shoulders the way they were that day when she got hit in the head with a rock. That romantic moment when she got clocked with a rock. And then Gaskell does something great. When Margaret tries to take the Helston roses out of Thornton's hand, she says, "You must give them to me." And he says, "Very well, only you must pay me for them." The next line is, "How shall I ever tell Aunt Shaw?" she whispered after some time of delicious silence. I think we know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Little kiss, kissy, hug, huggy.
And boy, don't they deserve it. After all the work that had to go into getting these two young lovers to this place, it's just mind-boggling and wonderful. So we're going to have a North and South chat, an opportunity for you to sit down and talk with me and other listeners. And if you have a webcam, see and be seen. If you don't have a webcam, it doesn't matter. You can show up. If you have a microphone, whether it's one that's on your computer or one that is something you can carry around with you, you can also talk and have a conversation with all of us. So, fun. That will happen at noon Eastern on Saturday, October 18th. That link is in the show notes, and I will be sending out our little Craftlit email newsletter. If you've signed up for that, it will have the link in it as well. I just discovered a voicemail from a listener that I had missed. This one's kind of important in a quilting kind of way.
Hi, Heather. This is Lori May calling. Lori 1176 on Ravelry and longtime listener and big fan of Craftlit. I'm calling on a beautiful, warm fall day along the San Francisco Bay. I first wanted to comment on your question about needles in episode 363. I'm not a big quilter, but I thought about a tip that my grandmother gave me many, many years ago when she taught me how to sew. This may not be a permanent fix or a big fix for lots and lots of stitching, but for a few stitches, use nose grease. This is my grandmother's tip. You actually rub your finger along the side of your nose, and then you use it to lubricate your needle, basically, and it'll just glide through the fabric. It's a great tip. I've used it often in the many, many years that she gave me that. The other thing I wanted to just mention is that I love to both listen to books and read books, and I almost always have at least two books going on Craftlit, the subscriber feed and the regular book, as well as hardcover books on my nightstand and books on my Kindle or iBooks. So I have multiple books going and love to read different books depending on the mood I'm in and the place I'm at.
Okay, so I am going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to imagine that if this were an heirloom quality quilt that I was going to hang on acid-free paper behind glass, I would probably not want to use nose grease. But for everything else in my life, it's such a great idea. Handy little tip for everybody. Thank you to Lori. And the audio came in kind of wonky because Lori was taking a walk by the San Francisco Bay. But the last thing she said was that she does have multiple books going all the time, both Craftlit and Premium, hardbacks on the nightstand, and Kindle books on the Kindle. And I think we can all identify with that. So, helpful sewing tip. I will now be on hiatus for a few weeks, getting our next book prepared and ready to go. And it's funny, isn't it the same time of year? Isn't this when I started North and South? Was right after Halloween? I honestly cannot remember. But be that as it may, memory or none, we will begin Her Land somewhere around the first or second week of November. I'll send a newsletter out. We'll have some kind of hoo-ha stuff going on, giveaways, whatever kinds of things. And that's what'll happen. I think that's it. Thank you so much for listening. I am so excited. We read all of Elizabeth Gaskell's book, and I feel so, I don't know, don't you feel morally upright and fabulous for having read this book that too few people had read, and is lovely, and Margaret is strong, and so is Thornton, all the, you know, the women in this book, not so much the shrinking violet thing. It's kind of nice. All right, have a great one. I'll talk to you in about a month with a new book, Her Land, by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, a comedy, mostly. Take care, have a great one, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.
Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Like us on Facebook, or leave a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Craftlit.com, or our dedicated Android, iOS, and Windows 8 smartphone and tablet apps. You can use the same free Craftlit app to access premium streaming content on the go. Craftlit is and has been made possible by the support of its listeners. And for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.